Testing 1, 2, 3, 4. Jeremy Bernstein, tape, November 27, side A. Born July 26, 1928, New York City. My father is a doctor. One sister, Barbara, married. Two children, lives in New Jersey, 6 years younger. Her husband is a lawyer. I was taught to play chess at the age of 12, but did not play seriously until about age of 17. When I joined the Marshall Chess Club in New York on West 10th Street, between 5th and 6th Avenue.
Okay. Whatever came along. Did you have any particular intellectual interests as a child? Did you remember? I mean, were you an avid reader or?
No. I had few intellectual interests as a child. I was a school misfit and considered, reading a book, schoolwork. And I don't think I read a book for pleasure until after I graduated high school.
What were you doing? I mean, your misfit.
I had one thing I think that perhaps helped me get over being a school misfit, and that is that I became interested in photography. About the same time, 12 or 13. And I think that if you get involved in any kind of problem-solving in depth on almost anything, it is surprisingly similar to problem-solving of anything, you know. I started out by just, getting a camera and learning how to take pictures and learning how to print pictures and learning how to build a dark room and learning how to do all the technical things and so on and so on. And then finally trying to find out how you could sell pictures and become would it be possible to be a professional photographer? And it was a case of over a period of, say, from the age of 13 to 17, going through step by step by myself without anybody really helping me, the problem solving of becoming a photographer. And I found that... I think, in looking back, that this particular thing about problem solving is something that schools generally don't teach you, and that if you can develop a kind of generalized approach to problem solving, that it's surprising how it helps you in anything, and that most of the deficiencies that you see around you in people that you don't think particularly you're doing their job right or something, is really that, I mean, assuming that they care, and, a lot of people that appear to care or may actually care are still not going about things particularly the right way. When you think about it, I generally find that it's just that they don't have a good generalized approach to problem solving. They're not thorough. They don't consider all the possibilities. They don't prepare themselves with the right information and so forth. So I think that photography, though it seemed like a hobby, and ultimately led to a professional job in photography, might have been more valuable than, doing the proper things in school.
Were you sort of the despair of your family at that time because of your schoolwork, or did you?
Well, it wasn't a real drama. I imagine so, but. It was never completely apparent until I graduated from high school that I couldn't go to college, because I graduated in 1945 when all the GIs were now pouring back on the GI Bill, and I had a 67 average, and it turned out that there wasn't any college in the United States, even of the lowest caliber, who would take a student with less than a 75 average in that year. So I couldn't get in. I failed to get into college.
Did you take all the scholastic aptitude tests and so on, or was
they? They wouldn't consider you. In other words, they wouldn't even accept your application if you didn't have a 75 average in that particular year.
Looking back and sort of in retrospect, you think not going to college was in a certain sense a fortunate thing? Or?
Oh, tremendously! Because what happened is that I had developed myself as a photographer, and prior to graduating high school, I had sold two picture stories to Look, And
what were they about?
One was about a teacher in high school named Mr. Traister, T-R-A-I-S-T-E-R, who taught English. And he used to dramatize Shakespeare. He would read the parts and act it out, and he made it very interesting. You know, it was one of the few courses that were interesting. You know, most of the English courses that I had consisted of the teacher saying, you're to read 5 pages of Silas Marner tonight, and the next day the class was spent in sitting at the book like Emil Jannings in The Blue Angel, looking up over the book and saying, you know, Mr. Kubrick, and then you stand up and they say, when Silas Marner walked out of the door, what did he see? And if you didn't know what he saw, you got a zero. and that was it. And as a matter of fact, I failed English once and had to make it up in summer school.
But did you show aptitude for things like mathematics and so on?
The only courses that I got good marks in were science courses.
Yeah.
I think I got, I can't remember now, but I think I got about an 87 in physics. Not in mathematics, though, but in science courses I liked and did reasonably well. But anyway, Traister was one, and I forgot what the other one was now. But they bought these two pictures. Oh, and I also sold them a picture. I sold them two picture stories and a photograph of a news dealer sitting on 170th Street in the Grand Concourse, right across two blocks away from Taft High School.
Is that where you went? Where, yeah. Taft High School, yeah.
With all the headlines saying Roosevelt, you know, dies, or FDR dead.
Yeah.
And he was sitting there looking depressed. And they liked this picture and used it in a whole series about Roosevelt, and it was sort of the final picture of the series.
Were you interested in extracurricular activities apart from photography as a high school student, in sports or stuff like that?
Well, I used to play, but I mean, I wasn't on any of the school teams.
Football?
No, I used to play everything, you know, but basketball and the concrete, you know, outdoor... what do they call them again?
Basketball courts?
No, you know, the playgrounds.
Oh, playgrounds.
The playgrounds, the city playground. And stickball, you know, in the street. And the odd softball game in the Taft dirt, you know, gym yard. They had a very large dirt gym yard. Things like that.
Would you say, Stanley, that
touch football in the street?
The fact that that you didn't go to college has given you a certain sense of what one might call irreverence for college graduates who don't meet up to what you would consider to be your, so to speak, your intellectual standards. I mean, if you come across a college guy who's got a lot of degrees but doesn't seem to radiate confidence, does it bug you?
No, I don't think that I don't think I look at it that way. No, the reason I think it was an advantage for me is that I then backed into this, you know, fantastically good job at the age of 17. I can't remember what it was, but I took some pictures down there. What had happened is that I could not get into college, and all sorts of things. My father, who was an alumni of NYU, Uptown, took me to see the dean, you know, and said, you know, this is my son, and I was the student here, and so forth, and nothing worked. So I started going to City College at night under the hope that if I got a B average for so many credits, I don't remember now, that I could then get into day school, a day college. But within about, I don't know, a few weeks of this, I was down at Look with some other pictures, and there was an extremely nice picture editor then, whose name was Helen O'Brien. And the managing editor at the time was Jack Gunther, who was then later killed in the Bryce Canyon, Utah plane crash. And she asked me what I was doing, and I told her, you know, nothing, and that I was going to try to, you know, what had happened. And she said... something about, you know, she thought she might be able to get me a job as an apprentice photographer. And, you know, so I went up to see Jack Gunther and so forth, and I got a job.
And how long were you a photographer, actually, on Look?
Well, I was an apprentice photographer for 6 months, and then I became a staff photographer, and I was there for 4 years.
I see. You were actually there until age 21.
Yeah. And, of course, that would have been the period I'd spent in college, and I think that what I learned and the practical experience in every respect, including photography, what I learned in that four-year period exceeded what I could have learned in school. And also getting out of school, I can't remember what was the particular turning point, but being out of school, I began to read, and within a relatively short period of time, I would imagine caught up with where I probably should have been had I had a modicum of interest in things in high school. Because, I mean, after all, you really only miss, I mean, before you're 12 or 13, how many serious books can you read? So I only really blew 4 years of part-time reading. How much time, you go to school all day, you play a certain amount, you got to do your homework. So in retrospect, I don't feel that I missed reading that many books. And I felt that I caught up pretty quickly when I became interested in things in general.
Well, what first gave you the idea of actually going into the movies as opposed to...
Like everybody else, you know, I was always very interested in movies, and I used to go to see films, and I'd say practically every film. And I used to see all the films at the Museum of Modern Art and the Thalia. And actually, at that time, when I was a teenager, there were the so-called art house didn't really exist in the to the extent it does now. You know, it was the post-war Italian the Rossellini pictures, which brought the art houses into existence. So there weren't that many good films that were ever played in. The theaters around, except the museum. Anyway, I used to see all the films, and I knew I'd seen them all a number of times at the museum. And a friend of mine, who subsequently has become a film director named Alex Singer, was working as an office boy at the March of Time. And one day he told me that it cost $40,000 to make a March of Time, and it was a one-reeler. And I said to him, gee, that's a lot of money. I said, I can't believe it cost that much to make, eight or 9 minutes of film. So I called up Eastman Kodak and checked on the price of film. And then I called up the laboratory and found out how much it cost to develop it. And I checked on how much it cost to rent 35mm movie cameras. And then I checked the cost of the other facilities, sound and editing and so forth. And... I forgot what it added up to, but it was something like that I could do a documentary film with an original music score and everything for about $3,500. So I thought, gee, if they're making these pictures for $40,000 and I can make them for $3,500, surely I must be able to sell them and at least get my money back and probably make a profit, you know? So... in fact, I think we thought that we could make a considerable profit because we assumed that if they were making them for $40,000 a piece, that they must be making a profit, you know? And so I rented a 35mm EYEMO camera. That's spelled EYEMO, which is a spring-wound camera, produces a professional picture. And I did a documentary film about a boxer named Walter Cartier, who I had previously done a picture story for Look about, and I knew him, and it was called Day of the Fight, and got the whole thing, you know, did everything. Alex helped me, you know, sort of carried lights around and assisted me, and I did the whole thing just myself and Alex and Walter and his people that he knew, and cut it, and another friend of mine who subsequently has become a professional movie composer named Gerald Fried, F-R-I-E-D, did a film score, and got the whole thing finished for $3,900. And then when we began to take it around to the various companies to sell it, they all liked it. But we were offered things like $1,500 and $2,500 and so forth. And
this is, by the way, when you were still age 21, roughly.
Well, less than that.
Less than refill.
I did this about, I'd say maybe 9 months before I quit. Look, about 20 plus.
Yeah.
And at one point I said to them, you know, Christ, why are you offering us so little for this? You know, one reel shorts, you know, get more than $40,000. And they said, what, you must be crazy. And I said, why do you think that? And so I told them about the March of Time. And anyway, they said it was, you know, was ridiculous. And shortly after that, the March of Time went out of business for the reason we later found out that they were spending approximately, I mean, you know, if the March of Time sues me for this, Alex somehow found out when he was working there that it was costing $40,000 to make one of their one reelers, and they went out of business. Well, anyway, I finally sold the film to RKO Pathé, who are no longer in business either, and sold it for about $100 less than it cost me to make it. I know it was a small loss, but I had the pleasure of seeing it shown, and you know, I remember I went to the Paramount Theater where it was playing with some Ava Gardner Robert Mitchum picture, and you know, it was very exciting to see it on the screen, and it got a nationwide and worldwide distribution, and so I thought everybody liked it, and they thought it was good, and I thought that this would be I'd get millions of offers, on which I got none to do anything, so I made another documentary, this time about a flying priest. Father Stottmuller or something in New Mexico, who flew a Piper Cub around to Indian parishes. I know RKO thought it was a colorful subject, and so I went there and pretty much on my own again made this short, and still, you know, nothing was happening. And,
were they supporting you for this?
No, they gave me $1,500, and of which I had to pay for the film, the travel, and everything. I made nothing. I think I lost money on that, too. But I had been making a reasonably good salary, it looked, for 4 years, so I had a certain amount of money, and I was still working. So then I quit Look, because I decided that there obviously wasn't any money in shorts, but that I then found out how much feature films were being made for, and, you know, millions, and I had calculated that I could make a feature film for about $10,000, and...
How did you calculate that?
Well, again, by, you know, projecting the amount of film I'd shoot, figuring that I could get actors to work for practically nothing, you know, work with, I mean, at this point, I was the whole crew, cameraman, assistant cameraman, you know, director, everything, so I had no cost, so... A friend of mine in the village did a script.
Were you living in the village in those days?
I was living on 16th Street, off 6th Avenue. And he did a script which was a terrible, sort of dull, undramatic, but very, very serious, allegorical story about four soldiers from an unnamed country lost behind enemy lines, trying to find their way home again. And it had lines in it like, we spend our lives running our fingers down the lists of names and addresses looking for our real... No, running our fingers down the lists of something or other, looking for our real names or our real addresses. I can't remember what the line is, but it was that kind of a thing, you know? And of course, totally failed to recognize what I didn't know about making films or anything. You know, I just thought, well, these other two things had turned out pretty well, but they were documentaries. And
the second thing had turned out pretty well.
Yeah. But I didn't really know what I didn't know, and I thought, well, Christ, there really can't be very much more to making a feature film, and I certainly couldn't make one worse than the films that I kept seeing every week. And, I wasn't satisfied to just make an interesting film. I wanted it to be a very poetic and meaningful film. And it was a little bit like the Thurber story about the midget, you know, who wouldn't take the bass on balls and decided to swing, you know. And so it, I got the film made, and but it was very, very dull. And it got an art house distribution. It was called Fear and Desire, distributed by Joseph Burstyn, who was the, at one time, I think he was the distributor who first brought in Rossellini's pictures. It got a few reasonably good reviews. It got a nice blurb from Mark Van Doren, and who was very kind about it. And it had a few, you know, it had a few good moments in it, but with the exception of one or two of the actors, they were all terrible actors, and I knew nothing about directing any actors.
Well, and how did you go about directing them? Just sort of.
Well, I just, I don't remember. You know, it was really, you know, just, it was really just, well, actually, from some of the so-called professional efforts I've subsequently seen, you know, people doing, I would say I didn't go about it that much differently than a lot of people do, but I didn't really know anything, you know. But there were some good moments in it, and as I say, it even got a few good reviews. But, it never returned a penny of its investment.
Was this your own dough you put up?
No. I raised the money privately. And then, while this picture was took a long time to edit the film and get all the, you know, the thing done, I spent over a year on it. And it opened at the Guild Theater in New York, and it was pretty apparent, you know, that it was terrible, you know. And while it was still playing, I decided, well, I'd better get another script very fast and try to promote some more money on the strength of just the fact that the thing was playing, because it wasn't apparent to me how I was going to earn a living or do anything, you know. And again, not one single offer ever to do anything, you know, from anybody. So I, in about 2 weeks, knocked together another script with somebody, and this time it was sort of a reaction to the other one. This was nothing but action sequences and a more sort of mechanically constructed sort of action gangster plot.
Was this the time you were also hustling chess, Stanley?
Hmm. I wasn't hustling chess. But I was playing chess for quarters. I mean, I wasn't a hustler in that I pretended not to be a good player and beat people. I just was playing in the park, you know, for quarter a game.
But were you actually were you doing this for the fun of it, or were you also hoping to make a living?
No, I was doing it for the fun of it, but I also did make about $2 or $3 a day, which it really goes a long way if you're not buying anything except food.
Well, do you still retain a lot of acquaintances from that era? I mean, the guys that you
there's only one friend who I still see, a boy named David Miller, who is a operations research analyst, and who I've remained friendly with. I still know all the people there, you know, like Duval and Feldman. And there's a guy named Edmund Peckover. But the regulars at the park don't change too much.
Well, was there a kind of fraternity of people playing for money? I mean, I don't know whether, you know.
Yeah, there was. Well, I mean, there were the regulars, you know. Like, the real regulars used to be Arthur Feldman, who was really the best player there.
He also played for dough?
Oh, yeah. I mean, all the regulars played for money. There was Arthur Feldman, I'd say, who was the best player. Then there was a guy named Joe Richman, who was probably the next best player. Then there was a guy named Edmund Peckover. I would have put him, say, third. And another regular was a guy named Amos Kaminsky, who was a physicist. He would have been next. Then I would say myself and David Miller, about equal. And then it was descending. I mean, I was only interested in the people who were better than I was, you know, so those are the ones that I particularly remember because they were enjoyable to play with. Then there was a whole lot of potzers, you know.
From whom you earned your living.
And semi-potzers, you know, and people who put up fierce struggles, you know, but who invariably lost, you know.
How many hours a day were you putting in down there?
Well, when I was waiting for things to happen, you know, waiting to get an answer on something, which went on for months, you know, sometimes, I would go there about 12 o'clock and stay there until, you know, midnight. I'd say a good 12 hours a day with breaks for food.
You were sort of playing under the lights?
Oh, yeah. In the summer, it was marvelous. You know, you'd
get out of doors with those concrete tables.
Right? Yeah. In the daytime, you get a table in the shade. And at night, you get a table by the light. And if you made the switch the right way, you had a good table all the time, you know.
But,
you know, there are those two end tables where the light is by the fountain that have the best light at night. And those were always the tables at night that you were trying to get.
And did you have a sort of regular clientele of guys who would just, you know, out of sort of misguided pride would come back? And
Well, I used to play, of course, a lot with the better players because they'd give me odds. And because, you know, they couldn't get a game, really. For instance, Feldman used to give me a pawn and move. And with a pawn and move, I never really kept track, but it was pretty even. I mean, Feldman didn't make his living off me, you know, but when there was no sort of real potters around, then the better players would play each other and would give, you know, fair odds, so there would be a pretty good game. Like there were some players that would just give you always white, which was a small advantage, but it was an advantage. Pawn and move, of course, is well, the smallest advantage would be white. Then the next advantage would be two moves, you know. And then the next one would be pawn and move, you know.
How did you stack up in the Marshall Chess Club, though? How would you stack yourself up in the Marshall Chess Club at that time?
I won the B tournament. And I played in one A tournament and finished around in the middle.
But you think that...
Well, I would like to point out to you that the A tournament, though, is not the top tournament. The top tournament is the club championship. So, you know, that's that. You can figure out where I stood.
But you think you would give Duval a pawn and move, roughly? Is that a serious appraisal?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
That's rather depressing. And when did you get launched after this point into the movies again?
Well, I as I say, when Fear and Desire was still playing the Guild Theater, I spent about 2 weeks lashing together this all-action script. And let's see, now what is he in relation to the family? Well, the guy's name was Mo Bousel, B-O-U-S-E-L, and he has two drugstores in the Bronx. Mo Bousel co-produced and put up the money to make Killer's Kiss. His name is Morris Bousel.
And that...
M-O-R-R-I-S, B-O-U-S-E-L. That was not a great financial success. It was at that time that I was playing chess for quarters in the park.
I told him that there was a...
Speaking of Jimmy Harris.
There was a guy in a village who was making films by himself, I mean, just doing everything together, and that he thought that you and he should get together and introduced you, and then Jimmy suggested that, I mean, this is the impression I got, which may be wrong, Jimmy suggested that he could take the producing burden of the films. Is that right? Finance the films or something?
Yeah, well, I had made Killer's Kiss, the second feature film, and substantially that's what happened. Well, first Jimmy and I made The Killing, and...
You made that by yourselves? Or?
No, we formed the company, which was called Harris Kubrick Pictures Corporation, and after looking for a story, we bought a book called The Clean Break by Lionel White. And this was the story that we made into The Killing for United Artists. United Artists had bought Killer's Kiss. Well, first of all, United Artists' function was only to finance and distribute the films. It was up to us to hire the people and make the film. And I presume that United Artists thought that if The Killer's Kiss could be made, you know, on the semi-professional basis it was, that with an adequate amount of money, which was fairly minimum anyway, that, you know, we could make a film. Jimmy had to guarantee completion of the movie, which means that if the movie ran over the budget, he had to put up all the extra money, which is a great safeguard. And especially since financially he was responsible to make this kind of a guarantee, it wasn't that much of a risk on the part of United Artists. Well, we had a very good cast, but none of the people were big stars in the sense that they were extremely choosy about what they were in. And I would say that all of them had probably been in worse films than they might have even at the beginning thought this one might turn out to be.
Wasn't Marilyn Monroe?
The principal cast was Sterling Hayden, Colleen Gray, Marie Windsor, Elisha Cook Jr., Joe Sawyer, Ted DeCorsia, Vince Edwards.
I saw that film.
Who, you know, became Dr. Kildare.
So long ago that I'm just trying to remember. Well, how was the one where Sterling Hayden dies in the end, isn't that right?
No, he gives up. The money blows away at the airport, and he gives up.
I'm very confused.
You probably haven't seen the picture.
No, I remember Sterling Hayden very clearly, but I can't.
You're thinking of the Asphalt Jungle. That's why you thought Marilyn Monroe was in it. He dies at the end of the Asphalt Jungle in a field with a horse.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, you're thinking of the wrong picture. You never saw The Killing.
Maybe that's
right. Yeah. If you want to see it, there's a print at the Museum of Modern Art. Artists, United Artists could give you the print. So anyway, we made The Killing, and somehow Dory Sherry saw it, and he liked it. And he was the first one who really showed any interest in us, so, you know, to the extent of offering us any sort of a deal to make another picture. And so we went to MGM and looked through the... The deal was that we could look through all their backlog of story properties. And, you know, if we found one that they liked, we could do it. And I think I tell you this. We came up with this Burning Secret by Stefan Zweig. And I did the screenplay with Calder Willingham, about which time Dory Sherry was, not taken out of, you know, his job. And the project came to an end. Sort of before, you know, just about the time the script was finished.
And it was at that point that you ran across the old war story.
Well, it was really sort of concurrent with this that I remembered reading Paths of Glory as one of the few books that I did read.
Is it a fair description of Jimmy to say that he's independently wealthy? Is that the...
Yes. You have to have patience because if you don't, your own frustrations prove to be too much of a distraction. It is a slow, you know, it's like those games where you jiggle all the balls into place. Sometimes there's more balls you're jiggling than others, but it's largely that. And if you allow yourself to become irritated, then it's just another distraction.
Well, how do you keep yourself, so to speak, amused when, there are all kinds of minor delays where something breaks and you've got to go sit down.
Because I keep thinking about the next things that I'm doing. You know, I just, I try to use all the time. That's why I found, for instance, when all these people were there, I found myself in a slightly up-in-the-air feeling. Luckily, this stuff was quite simple. But I usually, I would imagine to anyone sort of looking at me, I have a sort of vague, withdrawn look on my face, because what I'm just doing is thinking about what I'm about to do or what other scenes. Why don't I just use the time to think? That it's like sitting in the park playing chess.
Well, I mean, you think about how to manipulate the actors and that sort of thing.
I mean, well, I think about whatever problems are problems. I mean, sometimes manipulating the actors aren't the problem. Sometimes the problem is the story or the schedule or a set that isn't completely designed or something. But whatever it is, I always have plenty to think about.
Well, how close do you permit yourself to get to the actors as friends? I mean, is it bad to be too friendly with the guys who are working for you?
No. I mean, if you can. I mean, in other words, if it's bad if you don't like somebody to have a bad social situation occur, like an attempt at friendliness, which turns out to be sour, or, you know, his wife goes away saying how terrible you are, or something like that. But, I mean, if you like the people, it helps to know them, and it's enjoyable to be with them.
Yeah. It's not awkward to apply discipline or anything? If you were, I suppose it isn't really discipline.
Well, it isn't discipline anyway, because unless the actor... it's so rare that you would ever get to the point where you'd say to the actor, look, this is my picture, and you're working for me, and you do it the way I want, or go home. Because what you really want him to do is to feel confident and enjoy what he's doing, otherwise he's not going to be able to do it very well. So somehow you have to be clever enough to, or persuasive enough to... although persuasive isn't even the right word, because I tend to believe that if you're right, people realize it.
are you usually right, Stanley?
Well, I try to be. No, but I have found that when I am right, you know, when in retrospect it turned out to be always right, and in doing it it seemed right, and so on, that you do not usually find difficulties arising if you're right. Unless the actor is incapable of doing what you're asking him to do for limitations of his talent or his emotional range or something, and he gets insecure and thinks of a lot of reasons why you're wrong, but really what he's trying to do is avoid failing, you know. But then really you should try to figure out what the limitations of the actors are and never put him in a spot like that. After leaving MGM and The Burning Secret, prior to this, Jimmy and I had bought Paths of Glory. I did a screenplay with Jim Thompson and Calder Willingham, and nobody wanted to do it. It was turned down by every company until our agent, Ronnie Lubin, L-U-B-I-N, interested Kirk Douglas in the project, and through Kirk's interest, United Artists put up the money on the basis of it being done for a very low budget in Europe. The picture was a moderate success, but it was nothing to create opportunities for us because of big grosses or profits. The reviews on it were very good. Many reviews were superlative, and from that point of view, it was an enormous success. The greatest virtue of the film was that I met my wife, Christiana, who was an actress. I was watching a television broadcast, looking for an actress, actually watching someone else, and saw her, and got in touch with her agent. She came into the studio. We met. I began dating her, and we subsequently got married a year later. She is a marvelous actress. She had done a lot of work in Germany. I would like her to act, but she has no interest in doing dull, routine acting things and is more interested in painting. If I ever have a part, a decent part for a woman, which for some reason I never seem to write into my films, she would certainly do it. This is followed by about 6 months spent working on a script for Kirk Douglas, which he didn't like and was abandoned, and some more months working on something which Gregory Peck was supposed to do for us, which was also abandoned because it wasn't liked, and followed by the offer from Marlon Brando to direct his Western, which resulted in 6 months of work, again, abandoned as far as I was concerned because I left the project 2 weeks before it started. This was followed by a script called The German Lieutenant, which again no one liked, and followed by Kirk Douglas's offer to take over Spartacus after a week of shooting, which I did. And
and you find yourself...
Yes, my narrative criticisms, which were at first so enthusiastically received, began to grow pale as time went on due to the counter-pressures of the writer Dalton Trumbo and Kirk's producer Eddie Lewis, L-E-W-I-S, who did not see eye to eye to me with me on the story. Between the shooting and the editing of Spartacus, two children were born to me, to Chris Jenner, Vivian and Anya and Vivian. I was on the picture almost 2 years. Children's names: Vivian Vanessa, age 5, Anya Renata, age 6, Catherine Susanna, Catherine spelled K and an E at the end, age 11. Only about 8 weeks was spent in Spain doing the battles and the big march buys. The whole picture was done on the back lot at Universal.
Did you get any sense of intellectual satisfaction out of Spartacus at all?
No, but it was, you know, again, an opportunity to work. And it was interesting to, from a purely, as an exercise, you know, to try to do scenes that you thought weren't very good and to try to make them interesting. I thought the first 45 minutes of the film, of the life in the gladiatorial school, which was simple, turned out quite well, as far as I'm concerned. But then the rest of the story, from the slave rebellion on to the end, I thought seemed a bit silly.
Let's see, and then what happened at that?
Well, during the making of Spartacus, we bought Lolita, Jimmy and I. And now nobody wanted to make Lolita. Actually, the history of all the films, practically, that I've done is that no one ever wanted to particularly make them. And we just sort of running out the clock managed to put the picture together someplace, you know. Well, nobody particularly wanted to make Lolita. And finally, Seven Arts, a company named Seven Arts, put up the money, and we made it. It was made in England.
Did you do? Did you yourself do a good deal of rewriting of the of the book?
Yes. Well, Nabokov and I believe, got along very well.
And
I know he liked the film very much when he saw it.
Is there anything that's particularly striking about the making of that film that you remember? Or?
Well, no. You mean anecdotes? Not really. I think the only thing that is regrettable about the film is that due to the incredible pressure against making the film and put on by the carload by all sorts of groups, although I think the film was faithful psychologically to all the characters and captured, I think, the sense of them, I think that the total lack of eroticism in the story, in this film presentation of it, spoils some of the pleasure of it. You know, you can imply all the eroticism you want, but there's nothing like delivering some to help understand a little more the enslavement, you know, that Humbert was under. I think that I would consider that a criticism of the film, but one that was, you know, if you the film could not have been made. You know, nobody would have made it at all, and it would never have been distributed. There was some criticism by some people that said that she looked too old, but I never thought that was a valid criticism, because it was one of those books where nobody bothered to really read the description that Humbert Humbert gave of Lolita. And they got this, that somehow it was a rather interesting example of sort of mass delusion, because it's inevitably people imagined her as being about 9 years old and looking about 9 or 10 years old. And yet there's a very clear description in the book of Annabelle, his childhood sweetheart. And he says in the narrative that were it not for Annabelle, they would never know Lolita. And then when he sees Lolita, he says that she was a perfect reincarnation of Annabelle. And Annabelle is described as a pretty sexy 12 and a half. I forgot. I don't exactly remember Annabelle's age, but I know that Lolita was something like 12 years and 3 months when he meets her. And then the story progresses through quite a few years. Well, Sue Lyon was actually just 13 when we made the picture. And I thought this criticism was not valid. Many of the people who wrote it, I know, didn't bother to really read how old he said she was and what she looked like. And there was this peculiar example of a lot of people imagining her as being about 10 years old.
It was strange. That was the first film you made where you proceeded really from an intellectual premise rather than from a story, or from an intellectual situation rather than from a specific story. Curiosity about the possible outcomes of nuclear strategy. How did that come about? When did that come about? After Lolita?
Well, I was interested in whether or not I was going to get blown up by an H-bomb prior to Lolita. But my interest intensified itself sort of concurrently with that. I believe that the Berlin crisis took place during Lolita, and about that time I became keenly interested and started reading up on all the, you know, literature, of which there is a terrific extent, you know, a tremendous lot. I read the spectrum. You know, I began finding after a while that I wasn't reading anything new, and I decided I knew the whole thing, you know. And it was then that I began to, the thing that struck me most of all about it was that at first, when you read the brilliant analyses and the games theories and Hermann Kahn, you're very reassured, because you start off by thinking, gee, you know, God, there are these bombs, and you get an image vaguely of sort of a World War II mentality. And then when you read the literature in the field, your first reaction superficially is you're very encouraged, because you suddenly realize there's this whole body of thought that's gone into the whole thing, and you think, yes, well, now I... And then as you read on and become more involved, then you begin to realize that all these things lead to very paradoxical outcomes. And in reviewing the whole thing, every line in it leads to a paradoxical point. And I suppose this was the most thematically obvious thing about Dr. Strange Love, was the paradoxical outcome of any particular line of thought.
Well, if it really is true in the real world that every line does lead to a paradoxical outcome, what hope is there for any of us?
Well, personally, I think that the hope is... basically just luck. The situation is simply, for just luck reasons, is never really put to are getting particularly great strain. A lot, of course, a lot has been done. A lot keeps being done about trying to improve the situation against accidental war and better command and control and more sophisticated threat technique of trying to graduate threats into as many steps as you can to leave as many alternatives and back away points. But the pressing thing is that at every period of history, the people always thought that they had, the power structure and the leaders always looked back on the previous period of history and thought that they had learned something. And I think that, the old thing about the only thing you can learn about history is that you can't learn from history is probably true, and that this illusion that you get that you're much more sophisticated and that you can never, it can never happen that way again, may be true, but the thing you don't realize is that it'll happen a different way. Now that everybody's very convinced that they'll never have another 1914 type situation, well, they may have a 1985 type situation that they're not prepared for.
Well, it's like what they say about the French army always being perfectly prepared for the last.
Yeah, well, most armies are. You'd find the occasional exception, like Nazi Germany, but inevitably, I think that as time goes on, the danger increases because the thing becomes more and more remote. I mean, the problem to begin with is that people do not react to abstractions. They only react to direct experience. Very few people are even interested in abstractions, and even fewer people can become emotionally involved or emotionally react to an abstract thing. The only reality that nuclear weapons have are a few movie shots of mushroom clouds and a few documentaries that occasionally show in art houses about the effects of Hiroshima, but that the atomic bomb is as much of an abstraction as you could possibly have. I mean, it's as abstract as the fact that you know that someday you'll die. It's something that you know, but you really do a very good job. No, and you do an excellent job of denying it psychologically. So, to begin with, because of the very effective denial and the lack of any evidence, there's almost no interest in the problem. I mean, I would say in the minds of most people, it's less interesting even than city government, And the longer the time goes on without the thing happening, this illusion is created that somehow it's like money in the bank or you're building up security. In fact, I think you're just becoming more accustomed to it. And more liable to think that at some point that you've been taking these wonderful precautions and that the chances are minimized and so forth, and then finally you will get confronted with a situation that you couldn't anticipate. For instance, even now I think that it surprises me that Russia and United States could do a lot to almost completely eliminate the possibility of accidental nuclear war without any real loss of security. Both of them could allow observers in key places to instantly authenticate whether or not a nuclear war was in progress, or it seemed to be in process of happening, and that if there were some nuclear accident or a screwball, a nuclear psychotic, the mad major or the missile that gets away, you can instantly authenticate that this might be true. I know that the United States seems anyway geared not to respond to, say, a single nuclear explosion any place. At least that's what they say, that they now have, they feel invulnerable retaliatory capabilities, and that the single city taken out would not start the nuclear war. But, again, you never know. That panic that happens when suddenly all the lights go out, like you described in New York City, that indefinable something that might just make the senior decision maker abandon all his previously beautifully worked out graduated steps of response, you never know. And it depends on who he is and what his personal state of mind is, what information is available to him, and so forth. The fact that a lot of effort has been gone to try to work out possible accidents, and I suspect that great precautions have been taken to protect against these accidents, but whether the human imagination is capable of really devising the subtle permutations and psychological variants to all those things, I doubt. The people who make up these worst scenarios are not really as inventive, say, as a great writer or as reality. I think Herman Kahn is a genius, and I think that he can envision certain situations, but when you read the many of the sort of worst scenario possibilities, they don't strike you as being the work of a master novelist. They don't really seem real. You know, they're political possibilities, but they don't have the real trappings of reality that might, you know, confuse and panic the decision maker in the real circumstance.
Were you surprised at the reaction to Strange Love, the fact that it was so widely discussed and so widely reviewed? And did you have any feeling of what the response would be to it?
Well, I mean, all films are reviewed. The discussion went beyond reviews, but it was quite obviously something that might become a controversial issue.
Well, when you got finished with it, did you have a sense that, in some sense, that it was a winner? I mean, was it a thing that you really?
Well, I was very pleased with it. I mean, when you say a winner, I mean, I thought it was a. I was very pleased with the film. It happened to also be a very successful film commercially.
How did Terry Southern get into the act?
Well, Terry came to interview me for Show Magazine shortly before I was leaving for London to make the picture. And I became friendly with him. I had read The Magic Christian in Flesh and Filigree, and I thought he was a terrific writer. And I came to London and started.
You had the script pretty well.
Oh, the script was done, and it was done in its black comedy form. A fact which a certain amount of confusion has been created about in certain areas. The script was done. Peter Sellers was cast. And I was coming over here to prepare the film. And I, you know, thought Terry was very talented. I never stopped working on a script. I like to work with somebody else because under the time pressures that you're under, you can't afford the sort of lapse of intensity that if you work by yourself, you might suffer. And Terry seemed like an ideal person because the style of the script was similar, you know, to his sense of humor. And so about 6 weeks before the picture started, I asked him if he wanted to come over here and work on it with me and do some more dialogue and revision. And he came over. He worked for 6 weeks, and that was it. I started the picture, and he went off and did some other things.
Have any of the pictures been as intellectually complicated as the present one? I mean, the 2001, and caused as many intellectual problems. I mean, it's a terrific undertaking trying to create the future in a way.
Well, I don't know what you, intellectually complicated isn't really the right description for it, I don't think. I mean, Strangelove was a more intellectually complicated picture, and, you know, it involved complex arguments and quite a few, abstract ideas, you know, clearly or comically stated. This is not as complex a picture. It's not as complicated a picture in terms of, ideas represented, ideas actually spoken. In praise of Arthur C. Clarke, it is true that he is I think the most poetic science fiction writer.
But he's also nearly the best informed, I think.
Right, he is scientifically the best informed. His narrative ideas, I think, are, for my tastes, the most appealing, and he has this rather unique poetic sense of the a sort of nostalgia for the the mountains that have eroded away over millions of years, and the millions of years in the future, and people looking back and forward, and you'll have to fix this up because it sounds like real crap, but it's very hard to, define it nicely, but
well,
it is true that he...
I find that every time I finish reading some story like that of Arthur's about, I always feel sad when I go to
right.
some element of sadness.
Right.
Either we've made Venus,
right.
contaminated Venus, or there are, he has a vision of something in the future which you know you'll never see.
Or right. Or something in the past that you can never know about.
Yeah.
Well, but I think that's marvelous, I think that somehow... without making it sound too pompous or precious, that he captures the hopeless but admirable human desire to know, these things that they never will, can never really know, and to reach for things that they can never, really reach or reach back, and it's very hard to say it exactly, but this sense of sadness.
Yeah.
And this poetic sense of time passing and the sort of loneliness of, worlds. I mean, he manages, I tell you what he also manages to do. He can take a star, a sun, say, and in that one story, I forgot the name of it, where the sort of sun creatures come towards Mercury. He can take an inanimate object, like a star or a world or even a galaxy, and somehow make it into a very poignant thing which almost seems alive. He has a way of writing about mountains and planets and worlds with the same poignancy that people write about children or love affairs. And also, although you haven't read the script and you shouldn't really try to refer to the story, there is the without underlining it, there is a contrast in the story between giant orbiting bombs, which you might say is the negative use of nuclear energy, and this particular spaceship, which leads to great fantastic accomplishments, which is also another the good use of nuclear energy.
Yeah. But I think one can one can talk about the Orion, which is something I wanted to do for a long time. In fact,
good.
I have a set
it's
of
a way of pounding that. Yeah.
Yeah, I have a set of notes somewhere at home which I once took down for just writing a piece on the Orion, showing sort of logically speaking why it is the only propulsion system that's worth considering if you talk really about interplanetary emissions. There's nothing else that makes any sense.
Right.
Fundamentally, because its operating temperature is at the escape velocity. That's really the crucial element in it. And so that's would be very nice actually to talk about the Orion and these absolutely magnificent paintings which the guys have been doing over there.
Right.
And of course, the other thing that strikes if you compare making such a fictional space mission with a real thing. The thing that amazes one is how fast everything is done. In the sense that if you make a decision, whether it's on a costume or on a lettering or on you get the satisfaction of seeing it created
in some form almost immediately.
Mm.
I mean, isn't that so? I mean, if you say...
Well, it doesn't seem almost immediately to me, but if I was used to...
Yeah, but I mean,
another
compared,
time
to,
scale, compared
to scientific time scale...
Yeah,
I mean,
it must
Christ,
be seen very quick, yeah.
I mean, in a scientific project, you make any suggestion like that, and maybe it's 6 months, or... I mean, you take a typical experiment in physics. The guy has a good idea for an experiment. By the time you get an answer out these days, typically it's a year and a half.
Wow.
So it's a completely different order of
things. It's interesting that you would feel that way, because to the average person, the time scale of a movie seems like time has stopped. Most people are so bored and so astonished when they see the pace of things. Somehow they have an image in their mind that it's all done in a week or something like that. And most people that I've found who don't come from your side of the fence think that everything works incredibly slowly.
Well,
which is interesting. It just depends what you're used to.
The thing, when you ship me over to watch that television thing, of course.
Oh, that's right. You thought so too. Yeah.
Well, but that's a different side of it.
Oh yeah.
That's a side of making these sort of quantal sequences in which you work for 3 hours to extract 30 seconds on the thing. That would drive me off of my head. But the thing which the technological side of it. Where you get an idea, say for a propulsion system or Christ knows what, and within 3 days, well, you've got a drawing there, and you've got some guy making a model, and you have a lot of thought on a different size. I mean, like what time scale these guys are using, Eastern Standard Time, and all that sort of stuff. Well, all this goes fantastically fast. I mean, the number of problems that you deal with and solve in a half an hour... Is more than you would deal with in a comparable scientific project in 6 months, in my opinion. Because of course, you're just working in a different medium, in a sense that you don't really have to worry, say, in the case of a spaceship, about the structural stability of these things. You know, I mean, you might spend 6 months or a year computing something out on machines. Well, you know it's gonna work and it can be designed. So or you take that as a premise and then you put something there which in principle is gonna work, and then you can stop at that point. I mean that's what really constitutes the difference in it's very interesting. I find it extremely remarkable.
If these things do work that quickly, the thing that does take all the time is to extract, say, 2 hours and 15 minutes of a story and really keep distilling and distilling and distilling and distilling and distilling, I would say that if you count the time that's spent during the shooting day also working on the story in rehearsal and rewriting and so on, I would say that an average of at least 4 hours a day has been spent on this story, much more than that, because in the real solid writing period it was like 8 hours a day. But let's just say it averaged 4 hours a day for 2 years. Say an average of 6 days a week. That's 24 hours a week times maybe 100 weeks. I'd say there's a good 2,400 hours spent on call it 2 hours and 40 minutes of story. So that's about 1,000 to 1, isn't it?
Yeah.
On the story. Now that's where the real crunch is put.
One doesn't get the impression that that film directors do think a great deal.
I mean, you say that. They're supposed to,
it
helps.
That they're great, sort of.
Let's get this quote. I think we ran out.
Quivering reed.
The analogy of using the frustrating, wasted time periods on the set for thinking. With thinking on your opponent's move in chess.
We're talking a thing about the daily working with or without cutters, which I didn't completely understand. He said that when he directs that he has a cutter who works every day, and that you do not have a cutter who works every day, and that this is somehow a good thing.
With the exception of a few directors, like David Lean, and, well, let's not say who, with the exception of a few directors, most people have their film edited by film editors as they go along. And then when the film is done, they look at the film and dictate some notes about it. And the film editor tries to do what they say, and then maybe they look at it again and they do it again. But basically, it's like trying to, redesign a city by driving through it in a car, you know. You can notice a few things and say, you know, put that traffic light in the middle of the street, or those buildings over there look kind of shabby or something. But if you really want to do it right, you must do it yourself, you know, piece by piece. So I think by now I have enough sort of ability to imagine the way a scene will come out so that I can tell, without editing the material, if I have enough film coverage and, you know, what I can do with it. And then I edit the film with the editor myself when I'm all finished.
But you haven't done any editing up to now.
No. Just the thing, just slinging together that thing is.
Because I don't see how you. I mean, you have these, you know, a couple of these few minute sequences, this and that. I don't see how you could edit that, really. I mean, well, how would you?
Well, you haven't seen them. That's only a fraction of the material. In other words, what you've seen is only the comings and goings of other scenes, to just show you what the set looks like. I mean, we've shot about 80,000 feet of film already.
See, what is 80,000 feet in time?
It's about, 5,400 feet an hour.
5,400?
It's six times nine, yeah. 5,400 feet an hour.
How much film will you shoot before the whole picture is done, would you think?
By the way, that isn't a lot of film. People have shot 1,000,000 feet of film, actually.
I mean, in their lives?
No, I mean in a film. If, say, a picture is 3 hours long, it would be 16,200 feet. So what ratio is that? That's about 50 to 1 or something, isn't it?
More. Yeah.
50-something to 1.
It's almost like 1,000. It's like almost like 1,000 to 1, isn't it?
No, it isn't. 90% to 1. That is it. Film directing, I think, is a misnomer for anybody that seriously wants to make films, because directing the film is only, you might say, one-third of the process. You know, writing the film, directing the film, and then editing the film is, you might say, the whole job. And it is really, it's only the old major studio image of how a film was made, that the producer held in his hand on the palette, you know, the various people, the artist, the cameraman, the actors, the film editor, and the director and so forth. And the director was really just sort of like a senior member of the crew. And that, you know, he had no real integrating status in what happened. I mean, there were the few exceptional characters, even in the great days of the Hollywood studios, who somehow exerted their authority over what went on. But even today, you know, you talk about directors have the right of, they call the first cut, which means they must approve the first cut, but then after then the producer can do whatever he wants.
So it's a meaningless right.
Virtually. And it's a right to try to persuade someone. Because, I mean, if you don't even have the right of the first cut, you can't even explain what you want. But I do the cutting myself.
You have a picture of yours at this stage. Is your picture completely goes out? Has always been like that, or is that a...
Let's see. It was like that on Dr. Strangelove and Lolita. And I think Paths of Glory, I don't remember. Subject to delivering the minimum censorship requirements to playing it. And the way you make that arrangement is that you say the picture will not be longer than a certain period of time, and that you will deliver the minimum required censorship so that the picture can be played. I mean, in other words, if they just say, give it to us any way you want, and you deliver a picture that is legally unplayable, they have to protect themselves against that, isn't it?
What do you feel about your pictures being shown on television?
Well, I wish that they didn't put the commercials in. The worst thing that they sometimes do is cut the films. But
you don't retain any rights over that?
Well, in some of the films I do. But then, you know, it's terribly difficult to police it. Because unless you see the film yourself, there are very few people who are qualified to tell you what was cut. Or, in fact, I mean, even if a friend calls up and says, you know, I saw such and such a film, and it looked cut, you know, and you say, well, what was cut out? They say, well, I don't know, but I think it was cut. Well, it's almost impossible to find out what was done. It's a peculiar problem.
Preminger just lost a court case over that.
Well, I believe his case was against interruption of commercials. I don't think he was the cutting issue. I don't know. Perhaps you're right.
Commercials were certainly the key thing.
Mm.
But Lillian Ross had a piece about that case in the in the New Yorker, and there she described the reason why he lost, which is basically that he knew what he was doing when he signed the agreement.
Mm. I mean, well, that's it. I mean, they either have the right to do it or they don't.